Hello, you're about to listen to one of our audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio/survey to complete a quick evaluation. That's webcastaudio.com/survey. Thanks for the feedback and enjoy this podcast.
Also, as a reminder, for more Microsoft webcasts, you can visit microsoft.com/webcasts. And again, I'd like to welcome everyone to today's IT Manager webcast, Microsoft Security Intelligence Reports, Latest Trends in Vulnerabilities and Malicious Software. And now without any further delay, I would like to turn today's session over to our first presenter, Jeff Jones.
Thanks, Tracy. Okay, well, welcome to everyone. I'm going to jump in and get started here in a second. This is the third security intelligence report that we've released, and the second one where we've had a vulnerability section. And I do want to encourage you to go ahead and type in your questions as they occur to you. If they're ones that we can answer then in the normal course of what we're presenting, your question will prompt us. We'll go ahead and try to answer it and do it that way. Any that we don't answer, they're a little outside of the flow. We'll come back together and try to answer all of those at the end. So go ahead and do that. Briefly about myself as I get started here, I've been in computer security in various aspects for about 20 years. I've been with Microsoft for 5 years. I will promote my blogs briefly. I have one on technet.com/security. Where I focus on a little bit more technical and personal stuff. And I also have a blog that's on blogs at csoonline.com. So in addition to this study and this type of analysis, I do a lot of other analysis and comparisons for vulnerabilities and security. So jumping in, this report covers a six-month period, the first half of 2007. We publish, not the very week after that ends, but a little bit later. That allows the data, the disclosure, and some of the information to settle down a little bit and give us time to analyze it. The report was launched a week or so ago and was presented on at the RSA conference in Europe. And it has four generally discrete sections. Software vulnerabilities in terms of disclosure, that's industry vulnerability information. I'm going to talk about that. Then we have a section that is specifically about vulnerabilities disclosed in Microsoft products, that's across all products, and about exploits that have been published and trends there. And then the following sections are about malicious software and potentially unwanted software. And Jimmy and Jeff Williams are going to talk about those. So I want to briefly talk about the sources for the first, the sections about vulnerabilities. We typically use the naming index defined by CVE, the common vulnerabilities and exposures. We do include some vulnerabilities that don't necessarily have a name assigned, if that's appropriate, as long as it's uniquely identifiable by some other method. We also, in some of the charts, you'll see things about complexity. You'll see some broad generic severity breakouts. That information cross-indexed from the National Vulnerability Database, the links there on the screen. Very good site. But that's not all. There's actually lots and lots of other sites. Anything that's referenced in either one of those two sites, vendor websites for their own security bulletins and for confirmation. And over time, we've built up our own internal database of things. Particularly, one of the things I've developed and use is a disclosure database. So, using the names as indexed off of these databases, I have my own reference on when it was first publicly discussed. Sometimes that's in a bug database, other times it's on bug track or things like that. So, the data that I'm going to show you on industry vulnerabilities is not when it was first listed in one of these databases, but when it was first discussed. So that might differ if you went to one of these sites and searched for the first 6 months of the year, for example. The numbers wouldn't exactly match because that would be based on when they were published in that database. And then I'm going to let Jeff talk to you a little bit about the sourcing on the other two sections we're going to cover today. Jeff?
Thanks, Jeff. This is Jeff Williams. My background here at Microsoft is I started a little over 7 years ago. Prior to that, I worked in industry as a senior network architect and other industry positions that had a deep root in security. In my time at Microsoft, I've worked in security consulting. I've been privacy officer for one of our divisions, services, support and consulting, and now I work in the Malware Protection Center. The data that we use to talk about malicious software and potentially unwanted software comes from a number of sources, primarily you, our customers. If you are our customer on one of these products, I first want to thank you and tell you that we wouldn't be able to put out such great detail if it wasn't for you providing the telemetry to us through our various products. The malicious software removal tool, which executes as part of automatic updates each month, has more than 350 million unique computers providing this feedback to us. The information we receive relates to the specific threats, but there is no personally identifiable information sent. Windows Defender has several levels of opt-in that allow us to collect some additional information about what we're seeing, not only for known software that is of interest either as potentially unwanted or malicious, but also unknown software which touches any of the auto start execution points which we monitor with our real-time protections. We also have Windows Live OneCare Safety Scanner, which is an online scanner that's available free of charge at safety.live.com. Windows Live OneCare, which is our consumer offering, focusing on antivirus and anti-spyware protection, as well as firewall, backup, and other reliability services. For enterprises, we have Microsoft Exchange Hosted Filtering, Microsoft Forefront Client Security, and other offerings in the future. Each of these provides us a great deal of information in aggregate from hundreds of millions of computers. Specifically, I want to point out that the malicious software removal tool itself during the first half of 07, which is the period covered by this report, was executed more than 1.9 billion times, 7.4 billion times since we released it originally in January 2005. I'll come back and talk a little bit more about potentially unwanted software, but now I'll turn it over to Jimmy.
Actually, it should be Jeff.
No. Yeah.
You're right. I'm sorry. Jeff?
Okay. So we'll move on to what is the first section of the report, which is vulnerability disclosure trends. So very briefly, this section is about vulnerabilities disclosed within the global ecosystem across all products. So it's not specific to Microsoft. I just want to be clear on that. The numbers themselves, I hope, would make that obvious, but I do sometimes get that question. It also includes traditional software, commercial and open source. It includes web vulnerabilities, mostly anything that could be assigned a CVI identification number. So with that, I'll move forward and talk about the trends. So it started, there's several interesting things. If you look at the chart here on the slide, you'll see we have a massive number of disclosures, and we have had for the past couple of years. So over 3,400 new vulnerabilities were disclosed in the first half of 07. And the unique thing about this period is that it was actually a slight decrease from the second half of 06. That's in total and in aggregate, and it was only by a few tens, by like 20. I'd have to look in the reports to get the details, but let's say between 20 and 30 vulns. So it wasn't very much of a decrease. But you can see by looking over the past few periods that the growth in the past few periods has you know, while the number is still massive, it's slowed quite a bit, so it's flattened out. Now, I will say if you look at just the first half period, so first half 2007 over first half 2006, 2005, and so on back, then we're still getting year-over-year growth in those periods, so if you look at that way. And the other thing, as you move forward, and I'll get a breakdown into these in various ways, and you can see some more of the detail. So the next thing I look at. It's really more of an interest for those of you who manage risk. There's some interesting things to see here. January, which has usually been the lowest month of disclosures for the entire 12-month period, wasn't, reversed that trend. It was the second highest month for the first half of the year. So that's a pretty significant change. Can't say, whether that'll continue or it's an aberration because it's the first time we've seen it. But in the past, if someone had asked me, which month should I take my vacation, I would have been very comfortable saying, well, you have the least disclosures in January. And that didn't happen this year. But again, the first week of the year, which when everyone's apparently recovering from Christmas and New Year's and the holidays there, including the security researchers, is still the lowest week of disclosure. And if you look at these charts, there's two sets of data on both of these on this slide. One is, and it's the much larger of the two, is the first half 2007 numbers. And the second one, which is the smaller of them, is the average from 2001 to 2006. So you can kind of see where they match and where they don't. So in terms of week, the first week of January was the lowest, but you can also see that it was higher, even though it was lowest, than any average week, than the average for any week, let me say it that way, over the past years, just emphasizing how much growth there has been in new vulnerabilities discovered and disclosed. Moving to the next one, this one's really just in some ways it keeps confirming. I basically broke it down by day of week. The interesting thing there is you can see that most disclosures happen during the week, Monday through Friday. The most popular day being Tuesday. I've checked the last two periods because we do disclose, we do release our bulletins, which ends up being disclosures of new vulnerabilities about 60% of the time. The Microsoft vulnerabilities for the period was a low enough number that even if every one of them was disclosed on a Sunday, for example, it wouldn't have changed these statistics. What it does kind of hint is that other people, perhaps for the same reasons, which is based on customer feedback, are also disclosing on Tuesdays in terms of security researchers. But the big one, the big thing you notice there is that not nearly as many are disclosed on the weekend as there are during the week. So moving on from there to look at severity. Now, I want to say something a little bit about severity because I use this very broad broad categorization of low, medium, high from NDD. Because it's useful across the industry, they apply it to all products. However, I will say is if you're looking at an individual product, I would encourage you to look at the vendor's assignment of severity and not these general severities. And the reason I want to make that point is particularly with long support periods, you could have the same vulnerability on different architectures, different products, or different platforms that have very different severity. So, for example, we frequently have something that will affect a newer product, Vista or XPS2, having a lower severity than if it's the same issue, for example, on Windows 2000. So you want to look at the vendor rating. That's equally true on third-party vendors. So Red Hat has the same thing. They support 2.1. They support Red Hat 5. They're very different architectures. And so severities can vary quite a bit across the products. Having said that, though, this gives a good idea just in terms of a broad definition of severity, low, medium, and high. And you can get those definitions on the MVD or the CVE website of where I pulled those. The interesting thing is the thing, the chart on the left is the same height as the first one I saw you and showed you in totals. If you can just mentally blank out the green and the orange chart and look at the blue, that's the highest severity. You can see that we don't have a flattening or a reduction, that we have a growth in terms of the high severity issues. That's the takeaway is I can't explain, why I think there's a flattening or any of those things. It would be basically speculation. But if we assume for a minute that, all the security researcher bandwidth is being utilized to find this sort of thing, and maybe that's why it's flattening. We also see that they continue to focus on the most severe ones they can find and disclose those. I also have on the right is the vulnerabilities by percentage, and that's based to the total for that period. So you can see on that one as well that where up and through the first half of last year, the low and mediums had been taking a bigger percentage, that reversed, and so over the last three periods, they've been shrinking as an overall part of disclosures. So very briefly on the next slide, I have complexity of exploit. Again, I pull this assessment of exploitability straight out of the MVD database. And generally, my observation is they put exploitability as easy if an exploit is actually published. That's not 100% accurate as you go back over time, but more recently there seems to be a correspondence between those two things. So if they say it's easy, that's based on the conclusion that somebody actually published a sample exploit for it. Thing to keep in mind as I move forward, particularly in the next section, is there may be it may be possible to do a run code exploit, but the easy exploit may be just a denial of service, something like that. But anyway, if you look at that trend there, the complexity was getting higher and higher up through the first half of last year. In the second half, it was still pretty high. And then in this most recent period, it's dropped back down to traditional levels. So we've got a combination of more severe issues that are less complex to exploit. So in theory, looking just at the vulnerability side of things, it looks like things are definitely getting worse there, and that you would see more exploits. It's interesting to keep that context in mind as we move into the next section in a couple slides. Disclosures. One of the things, over the past couple of years, there had been a lot of speculation that there seemed to be a focus shift in the researcher community to find vulnerabilities in applications as opposed to operating systems. So I worked on a method to figure that out, basically classified things as part of operating system if I could, and everything else became non-operating system, or as it's labeled here, application vulnerabilities. I'll say in a broad sense, application there also includes web apps, anything that's basically not an OS. And you can see that I'm not sure this chart shows it the best, but there is a general trend downward on the percentage that is attributed to operating systems, and a trend for more and more of them being in applications. So I think that's a natural trend when you consider how many more new applications there are added when you include web ones and things like that versus operating systems. So a few things, based on taking this data, you can adjust your risk management processes to ensure everything is protected. We have some links here for prescriptive guidance for IT professionals. Also, I encourage you to participate in the IT Pro Security Zone. There's several activities there where you can do that. And the Microsoft Security Newsletter, it's a combination of very practical articles and how-to certain things, as well as a viewpoint type articles. So all those are resources and ways to help with these. Now, I'm going to move into the next section, which is about exploit trends. Want to distinguish this. This area of research, we focus just on vulnerabilities that would apply to Microsoft products. Now, that's all products, across the spectrum, not just Windows or Office or things like that. But it also excludes, whereas the section I just finished talking about was across the industry as a whole, this is just ones that would apply to Microsoft products. So one of the interesting things at the top level is that as vulnerabilities continue to grow the volume of them, the volume of vulnerabilities in Microsoft products is actually at a lower rate in terms of growing, though there's still some growth. And then the percentage of those that have exploit code published, again, against Microsoft Linux, is at an even lower rate, and it's flat and actually a little bit down in this period. So that's good news. That's a good indicator for Microsoft and for users of Microsoft products. I'll give you a little bit of detail here. Moving to the next one, you can see here, looking down the left in the number of exploits in 2006 and then in 2007. This is the first time we've had this section, so the analysis we did is a little bit broader than we have in the other sections where we're going period over period. But exploit code for newer products seems to be harder to find. So if you look down here, the general trend is stuff that has been released in the past few years that has leveraged the security development lifecycle, where we've had a focus on improved security quality. It appears that it's paying off in the sense that there's more exploit code available, implying it's easier to develop for some of the older products. Because of that, that makes it harder, just a less volume of exploits to be developed against the newer products. And you can see a distinct decrease in things like later versions of Windows and later versions of Office versus their predecessors. So that's, I kept that section fairly short. If you do have questions on it, there's much more information in the report itself. If you have any of those, dig those questions out. I'll hang around towards the end, and we'll try to get back to them as well. So a few things here in terms of just strategies and mitigations. Because we do observe a difference on vulnerabilities which require mitigation faster in terms of they have an exploit available. So you can leverage that as well. The information is not hard to find. There are some pretty common sites that publish sample exploit code or exploit code. If you use those, you can prioritize mitigations ahead of ones where exploit code is not available. In a more general sense, you can use the severities that we've talked about as well in the bulletins from vendors. I will call out that in the product-to-product comparison, it seems like the newer products, which have had more of a focus on security and development, do have a less risk associated with them. So if it's possible in your enterprise, then moving to the newer products that have been developed under SDL seems to have a security and a risk management benefit as well. And then, of course, I encourage you to sign up to vendor-specific security information for us. We've got security bulletin webcasts where we have a conversation like this after the publish, but if you have your other vendors and they have those types of resources, then you would want to use those as well. So that's the end of the two sections about vulnerability industry as well as vulnerability exploit trends in the vulnerabilities of Microsoft. And I'm going to turn it over to Jimmy to talk about trends in malicious software. Jimmy?
Good afternoon. This is Jimmy Kuo, and since I didn't have the opportunity to introduce myself before, I'll start with that. I joined Microsoft about a year ago after having spent well over 10 years with McAfee and a few more years before that with Symantec. And I've been in the antivirus business for all those years, which is now more than 15. Some people refer to me as being a grandfather in this industry, probably primarily because of all my white hair now. But I'll be here talking to you about the malicious software trends. And primarily, this data is from... This data is gathered from many of the sources that Jeff Williams already covered, but mostly it's related to the online scanner and MSRT and OneCare and all those type of things. Starting off, we're going to cover the instant messenger, the IM arena. In the IM arena, backdoor Trojans have pretty much gotten to a point where they dominate all the numbers. First of all, we collect the IM data with Windows Live Messenger, where you can subscribe to either Windows Live OneCare Safety Scanner, or you can note that you have an antivirus already installed, and it's from that data that we get all of this. In the IAM arena, the primary issue here is that in IAM, you basically talk to people who you know and who you have in your friends list. And in order to get within the circle, you have to basically infiltrate it. And so in order to do that, what the bad guys are doing is they're putting backdoors onto these machines. And once they get in, they get into the circle, and they start sending IAM messages that have links and that entice your friends to click on the links and then install and so forth. And so basically, this is one of those, you send and infect two friends and they infect their friends and so on type of scenarios. The primary purpose of all this is essentially to own the machines, because in addition to getting into your IAM network and sending all this stuff, they also have control of your machines through an IRC IRC bot. IRC is an internet relay chat, and in order to control your machines, they make use of internet relay chat channels and send the commands through that channel. In the email arena, we get our data from EFS. Let's see. Right now, I can't remember what that stands for. But basically, we manage some online email services, and from that we get this data. And from this data, we see that in basically phishing scams and email scams account for 37% of all the malware detections. And Trojan downloaders account for also a huge amount. And like the IAM arena, we have a scenario here where basically these things are being used as first step lures. And you send somebody an email and then with an enticement to then click on the email and then download the Trojan later. With what we've been detecting through email, last year in the first half of the year, the primary virus that was being detected was the Sober worm. Sober works in the January-February time frame and actually has a clock, so it only knows to work in those time frames, and so it drops to zero in the second half of the year, and then picked up again in the first half of this year. And then the other viruses that are being picked up are from the Bagel and the Netsky families. And they're not really all that significant, except that they send lots and lots of emails. Now, we registered essentially a decrease in the amount of viruses and that we've been detecting. The biggest reason, though, is that we're putting more rules into the initial filtering. So last year at this time, there was 53% that were of the incoming email that was being filtered. So basically, if you had 1,000 emails, 530 of them were being filtered already, and so the scanner was looking at 400 something, and out of that 400 something, it would be able to pick out two malicious emails. So you basically had 400 something good emails within your 1,000 emails. But today, we're actually filtering in the range of 94% to 96%. So out of 1,000 emails, you really only have 40 good emails. And so despite the fact that we're now detecting much fewer malware being sent through sent through email that's actually getting through to our scanners. The reality is that most of the email is already being filtered out by preliminary rules. These rules would include such things as all the spam-related rules and such things as certain limitations on attachments. And these rules filter out so many of the emails that the rules become the dominant issue rather than the actual scanning that's left. So the amount of detection of the rest of the incoming email falls very secondary to the actual rules that you have on your email filtering. Our next arena comes to Windows Live OneCare. In the Windows Live OneCare area, the biggest difference is that Windows Live OneCare is an on-demand scanner, and there is no real-time protection. And what we see here is that Windows Live OneCare, you basically have two classes of infections, adware and possibly unwanted software, and then you have downloaders and droppers, and you have Trojans. This first class pretty much dominate the second class of malware, which is the backdoors, the password stealers, the viruses, and the worms. So we have minor increases in, minor increases in password stealers, but these numbers are pretty small. The big numbers are in the adware and potentially unwanted software arena, and in the virus and the downloaders. And what we have here is the Zilog family primarily dominating the numbers, although it's only at 3.7%. Okay. On this chart, this chart may require a little bit of explaining. On this chart, the right portion, the green area, represents OneCare versus the orange, which represents the safety scanner. What we have here is that the OneCare numbers will add up to 100%, and the orange ones is actually a normalized representation against the OneCare numbers. And what we're showing is that using OneCare, you will detect many more instances of these of this malware on trying to attack the machines. And we believe that this is the result of OneCare having real-time protection as opposed to the online safety scanner, which only happens after people suspect that they have something on their machines. With Windows Live OneCare, we have downloaders being detected 18% of the time, potentially unwanted software being detected 20% of the time. And this is a comparison of all those things that are actually being detected by Windows Live OneCare. Now we move on to the MSRT. The MSRT, beginning in 2002, second half of 2005, we started to keep track of the number of machines cleaned, and that's why in the first half of 2005. You don't see that number. Since that time, we've removed 50.3 million infections from 20.5 million computers. In the first half of 2007, we removed what you can see significantly more than in the past. And these numbers account for almost 40% of all of the previous removals. In the first half of 2007, we removed malware from 1 out of every 217 machines. That's compared to 1 out of 409 in 2006 and 1 out of 359 in the second half of 2005. That shows people that really in the first half of this year, we've undergone significant attack on the machines. But in addition, we're able to remove a lot more because we add much better detections and much more prevalent or detections for much more prevalent families. So these numbers are also influenced by the fact that we're adding signatures for very prevalent families and cleaning the ecosystem with these signatures. If you want to know which families are included in the MSRT, the knowledge base article of 890830 lists all the families, and as of June of this year, 89 families are included in MSRT. This figure shows you the breakdown of all the different categories of malware that's been removed by MSRT. And what you see here is that the downloaders and droppers are your primary set of malware that's removed, and your secondary set is the backdoors. So in a scenario, what we have on the internet is that you get the lures, and the lures install a downloader and or droppers. And what happens is that after the downloader is installed, it allows another piece of malware to be installed onto the machine. And that may be immediate or that may be slightly later. The backdoor category allows the bad guy essentially to control your machine from afar. It's generally these are your botnet type of scenarios. Now these percentages, when it talks in the second button, the percentages are relating to a slide that's coming up. But we're talking about just from the infected machines. Here we have a list of all the malware that that MSRT has been able to remove from various machines. What you see is that Zlob has been removed from 1.7 million machines, and Rhinos, which was added in May of this year, was removed from 1.3 million machines. So Zlob was actually added to MSRT over a year ago. So what that shows is that there are actually full 6 month comparisons, and that Zlob is continuing to infect machines, and there's people actually out there making new versions of Zlob and infecting machines, and whereas Rhinos, the Rhinos number represents only 2 months worth of data collection. So the Rhinos number, if it was given 6 months, probably would be quite comparable to the Zlob number. You can't really multiply by three because whereas we added Rhinos into the May MSRT, it actually cleans off all the machines that were infected for all the months prior. So there is an initial kick in the numbers, and then in the following months, the month-by-month numbers will be less. So I can say that Rhinos would be higher if it was a six-month number, but you can't really say that it would top Zlob. But the other thing here, the BronTOC coming in at number four with 172% increase, that's another comparison where we have a six-month comparison in this period versus a two-month comparison in the previous period. So whereas the computers cleaned obviously is a good number in this chart, the comparative number of 172% increase is not something that's a good comparison. So if we look at the jump here, we go down to number 12 of the IRC bot, and what you see there is that there's a huge increase in the use of IRC bots over this past 6 months. But even still, though, that only represents about one-fifth of each of those top two cases. So Zlob and Rhinos pretty much are your biggest families out there. Now, in using the MSRT, we have the ability to catalog who's running the program and from where. This information is volunteered through the MSRT and we capture the locale and the region that where it comes from. Now, from that, we're able, and also, of course, which operating system it runs on and all that stuff. From that, we're able to derive many of the charts that you'll see coming up. The first chart is the most significant. Here, what we have is that malware was actually detected the malware that's reported to MSRT, 87.7% of that comes from Windows XP SP2 machines. But we also know that Windows XP SP2 is the dominant factor of is the dominant OS among machines that are currently operating. So we have to actually do some sort of normalization. That is, in order to understand what type of operating system is most easily infected, we have to look at the number of machines that are running MSRT compared to the number of machines that that actually report malware on those machines. So you take the number of infected machines and divide by the actual number of reporting machines, and that is the normalization. Then taking those numbers and comparing them against each of the each other of the operating systems, we have this the first half of 2007 normalization chart. And this is the chart that comes out as very striking. What we are able to show here is that MSRT cleaned 60% less malware, or cleaned malware from 60% less machines that are running Windows Vista than computers that are running Windows XP SP2. So looking at this normalization chart, when you see these percentages, you're able to use these percentages to compare against each of the other operating systems. So Windows XP SP2 says 7.0, and Vista says 2.8, and that represents that it's 60% less. If you want to compare Windows XP SP2 at 7 against the original Windows XP without any service packs, then that would show that you're about one-fourth, so 20% as infectable as Windows XP without any updates. It's interesting to note also that get some of these numbers for you, but over time, like 3 years ago, or I'm sorry, 2 years ago, Windows XP SP2 compared to Windows XP was at about 6 ratio, and now it's at about 4.5 ratio. So over time, what we have here is that the early adopters are a bit more savvy, and so they're also less likely to be infected already, regardless of perhaps the operating system that they're using. And then as the years go by and that operating system becomes dominant, then the numbers really settle down. So right now, we're able to say that Windows Vista is perhaps somewhere at 60% less infectable than XP SV2. Probably over time, this number would go to somewhere around 40 or so, but it will still be significantly less than XP SV2. And of course, the really big difference here, Windows Vista compared to XP without any service pack installed, is at a whopping 91.5% less infectable. Now, as I mentioned, we're able to grab locale information, and from that we're able to build some sort of charts that tell you which country or which area is more infected than others. And here we have the highest and the lowest, or the most and the least infected countries. You see from the least infected countries that they're basically the higher per capita countries. And we would postulate that the highest per capita countries, the people are more able to afford security products and are more likely to be more computer literate, and therefore will keep their machines more safe than the the most infected countries. And this chart in its entirety can be found as figure 30 in the actual SIR report. Because the number of countries is so big that if we filled them out into one huge pie chart, that pie chart would just have too many slices and become too congested. We decided to break down the information into regions. And here we have the normalized charts for Asia Pacific and for the Middle East. What you see here, Mongolia is the most infected area in the Asia Pacific region, and the Bahrain and Egypt are the most infected areas of the Middle East Africa region. Careful with the numbers. The numbers you can use to compare only within specific charts. So you can compare Mongolia against Thailand and say that Mongolia is three times more infected than Thailand on a per machine basis. And you can compare Bahrain against Egypt and Iraq and basically the countries on its own chart. But you cannot compare the actual numbers across charts. So the Mongolia is 25 and Bahrain's 8.7 are not numbers that you compare directly with each other. The actual chart for most infected, as I said, is available in SIR so that you can compare country against the whole collection of all the countries from all the regions. Here, see the number of comparisons against countries only within their own region. In Europe, Albania is the most infected, followed by Turkey, and the least infected regions are Finland, Italy, and Austria. Again, it somewhat represents a list of, for the most part, per capita. And then we have the Americas. See, in the Americas, the United States falls in at 2.9%. Again, this 2.9% does not say that 2.9% of the machines are infected. This is 2.9% only as comparison to the other countries' numbers. So 2.9, let's say, compared with Chile, we are about half as infected as Chile, and about one-third as infected as the Dominican Republic, which would be the highest ranking in the Americas. The MSRT has collected information that also shows, this chart here represents the number of variants that are occurring in each of these categories. So basically what this chart can tell you is that in these areas, where are the bad guys actually doing work? Because in order to create variants, generally somebody's actually working on them, keeping them fresh. For the purpose that they want to create a new variant today that is not being detected by any of the antivirus vendors so that it can possibly squeak by detection for a few hours. So with these numbers, what we see is that the bad guys are actively working in the Trojan and downloader arenas. The exploit number is pretty high, and that's because of the way that we count these numbers, and the exploit count is because each web page that houses an exploit comes up as a different variant for us, and so the exploit number perhaps should be a bit lower, and that again highlights that your biggest two categories are your Trojans and downloaders. Okay. Now, these variants as to when they're coming in each month, we see, I would say from this chart, it's relatively flat at about 100,000 variants a month. You have your peaks and valleys, but it's pretty steady at about 100,000 variants a month. But what's significant here is that for a while now, we've been detecting our malware using a lot of generic family type of detection, and we're able to actually get over 80% of the malware with these generic detections. So that is to say that when the bad guys are releasing malware, 4 out of 5 of their new releases are already detected by our generic detection capability.
Okay.
So that pretty much covers the data and the understanding all of that data. And now comes a couple of slides of suggestions and strategies for dealing with countermeasure, dealing with all of this. And most of these you've probably all heard before, using a firewall, using an up-to-date anti-malware product, and of course keeping your updates up to date. And then when you're looking to download any files, make sure that those files are being scanned. If you're not running antivirus with real time, which we highly recommend that you run antivirus with real time protection on, but if you're not, make sure that you're scanning your downloads immediately before you use them. In the handling of your email, if you're supporting a corporate email system, you want to come up with very good rules to just filter out the incoming, because essentially well over 95% of all incoming email is quite likely to be bad. And basically, if there is a live person out there who is trying to send email to one of your charges, one of your someone in your company, and they face an email rule that says, no, you're not allowed to send us any doc files. Well, they'll figure out a way of sending the file, perhaps by changing the extension, and then send that through, or perhaps post it somewhere so that the person who needs it can go and download it. And of course, if there isn't somebody actively out there trying to send something to you, which means that there's a bot out there that's being controlled to send malware to you, they won't know to go and change their sending method, and those files will just go into the bitbucket. So as I noted when I was going through the email section, it's very important to have good rules covering what your company will accept for legitimate email. And then it's very important to install a phishing filter. For instance, the IE7 comes with an automatic phishing filter, and they can block people from going to a bad location on the internet. And we highly recommend that you actually have MSRT run once a month. It's only once a month, and it's targeted against the most prevalent threats. And if for some reason there's an outlying computer somewhere that that isn't getting good updates, at least have it checked on a schedule of at least one. And now I'll pass it on to Jeff Williams, and he will talk about potentially unwanted software trends.
Thank you, Jimmy. As we've looked at some of these trends, we focused on malicious acts, those which are unwanted by everyone. However, we also have a class of software that we refer to as potentially unwanted software, which in some cases, some users want it and others don't. Because of this, we've categorized it separately, and we'll describe it in this section. As we go through the data, it's important to recognize that the standalone version of Windows Defender was released on October 23rd. And subsequently, we released additional languages in February and May. Currently, we have 23 languages available, including English, German, Japanese, Italian, Spanish, Dutch, Portuguese, both for Brazil and Portugal, Russian, Korean, Chinese for both China and Taiwan, Danish, Hungarian, Norwegian, Swedish, Czech, Finnish, Hebrew, Arabic, Polish, Turkish, Greek, and we find that by having these localized versions, we're able to get a deeper insight into those regions as the individuals in those regions who may not speak English are presented with actionable information about what is running on their computer so that they can make a decision as to whether or not they want it to run. It's also important to note that Windows Defender runs only on XPSP2, Windows Server 2003, and is a component of Windows Vista. When we look at the ratings of software using Windows Defender, there are four different levels that we might rate software in the Malware Protection Center. Our researchers will analyze the behaviors of the software, and based on those objective reviews of the software's behavior, we'll assign it a category, such as adware, spyware, monitoring software, and so on, as well as an alert level, low, medium, high, and severe. Those alert levels are simply relative listings of the level of attention you should pay to this software based on the objective review as well as voting data from our customers who have chosen to either keep or remove that software and sent that information back through the SpyNet community. It's also important to recognize that when we look at some of these data in more detail, we can't jump to conclusions about whether something is wanted or unwanted simply based on an ignore value. We should look at instead ignore always, which is an active choice saying that the customer actively wants that software, or the choice to remove or quarantine that software, also an active choice. In most cases, we will prompt the user to make a decision rather than have a default value for which action the user should take. Though the higher the severity, the more likely it is we will suggest to remove that software. The goal of Windows Defender is to provide visibility into what runs on a computer and control for the individual as to whether or not that software runs. As we look at some of the next tables and go into much more detail, we'll look at the top 25 potentially unwanted programs ranked by the frequency they're removed. The top 25 programs removed account for about 44% of all removals. This is a decrease from 56% in the second half of 2006, but still indicates that a few number of players are responsible for the bulk of potentially unwanted software. In this chart, you'll see the top 25, as I've mentioned. They're ranked according to the percentage that they're removed. The table also includes the percentage of each action that our user base has chosen. As we'll see, there's a stark difference between different items in this list, where some are removed very frequently and others not so much. This has to do with the type of software, whether or not it's part of a bundle and there's a value proposition for the individual, whether or not there is legitimate utility to some of the software, and a number of other factors, including geographic, social, and other considerations. As we look at the list, we'll see that number 21 is the Win32's LOB family, something that Jimmy discussed earlier. It's the most frequently detected, with 3.2 million detections in the first half compared to 2.4 million detections in the second half of 2006. We also have two new entries in this period, Win32 WinFixer at number 7 with 1.2 million detections, and Trojan Downloader Win32 Rhinos at number 4 with 677,000 detections. But it's typically more interesting to look at this software by category when we're trying to assess trends that we're seeing. Changes in prevalence by category might be indicative of a larger overall movement towards more deliberately malicious behavior as we see a continuing trend we observed in the second half of 2006 with Trojan downloaders. We see a marked increase in their prevalence not only in the malicious software removal tool, as Jimmy described, but also in Windows Defender. We also see remote control software increasing 277% in the second half of 2006, remained comparatively steady this period with a 13.8% increase over the second half of 2006. Adware, which had a 59% change in the second half of 2006, also was comparatively steady in the first half of 2007, which is in part due to some actions taken by the United States Federal Trade Commission as well as other regulatory bodies against specific providers. Conversely, we do see software categorized as spyware dropping from 60% increase in the second half of 2006 to a 14% decrease in the first half of 2007. This was offset by an increase in Trojans up from 57.4% in the second half of 2006 to 117.8% increase in the first half of 2008. This is consistent with what Jimmy described with the increase in downloaders that we see with the malicious software removal tool. It's also important to note that new to this list is the category of exploit. We're seeing a much greater prevalence of exploits attached to potentially unwanted software than we've seen in the past, with a 122.8% change for the reporting period, again suggesting that there are an increased number of instances of the purveyors of potentially unwanted software moving into clearly malicious behaviors and criminal distribution. One of the largest factors in the dramatic increase in potentially unwanted software is the category, is the type of software, rogue security software. It posted the highest overall change for the period. This class of software often advertises as a spyware or virus remover or other security scanner, and thus ironically, this increase may be the result of individuals attempting to better protect their systems. Unfortunately, the software may report false infections, fail to remove existing infections, or may install additional malware onto the system. We have a more detailed discussion of rogue security software in the previous version of the Security Intelligence Report, which you can find at Microsoft.com/SIR. We can also look at the prevalence of potentially unwanted software by operating system. And probably the most important point to take away from this slide is that Windows Defender detected 2.8 times less potentially unwanted software on computers running Vista than on computers running Windows XP SP2 when we look at our normalized data. This is consistent with what we see with the malicious software removal tool and indicates that there is a higher level of assurance when running a more up-to-date operating system than with running one that's previous to the current version. We can also look at this data by country. And before launching into the data, I want to remind you that the availability of the software in a local language will affect the number of detections we have in that region, because an individual who's running software is likely to do so in their local language rather than a language that is not their primary. The result of this is that we see a skew for English language speaking countries such as the United States, United Kingdom, Australia, higher than other regions. But we've seen a remarkable increase in Japan and Germany over the previous period due to the introduction of software in those languages. The same holds true for France, China, and Italy. When looking at this chart, we can compare the percentage change between the region, but factoring in the availability of the local language as we do it. So it's important not to draw unwarranted conclusions about the relationship between a country and the percentage of potentially unwanted software in that country. Another way we can look at the data, and this is one that I think is quite interesting, is to look at it by geography. Now, we had the discussion about locale data with the MSRT, but we have a more granular view with the Windows with Microsoft Windows Defender in that we can drill down to the country directly. What we see as we look at different countries is that we see a different percentage mix of the top items that we see. So, for example, we see in the United States, United Kingdom, France, Australia, Netherlands, and Canada a different mix of those top items. More detail is available in the Security Intelligence Report, but the important takeaway is that regional, language, and distribution factors all factor into whether or not potentially unwanted software is available in a particular geography. We can see the same in other countries that we've looked at, and in some cases we see a very distinct high prevalence of a particular piece of software, such as in Japan with CNS Min. We also see completely different different potentially unwanted software in China than we do in other regions, again, mostly due to language and distribution differences from other countries. As we think about these types of software and the impact that it can have on us, the frequency that it appears, and the number of detections overall that we see for each of the top items, it's important to think about how we can protect ourselves from it. One option is to use an anti-malware product from a known trusted source and keep it updated. Another is to look at what is the most frequent distribution method, or one of the most frequent distribution methods, such as ActiveX control and browser modifiers, and look at taking advantage of technologies such as the Windows Internet Explorer Administration Kit, which can control which ActiveX controls are allowed to be run, allows the administrator to supply specific security settings for each security zone, such as to restrict active content in the Internet zone, and to install security updates and patches for all applicable software on an ongoing basis. It's also important to configure and use the protection provided by the Internet Explorer security zones. The more restrictive the security zone settings are for an untrusted site, the less likely you are to find potentially unwanted software or malicious software installed on your system. And as Jimmy mentioned earlier, it is important to use a firewall to protect your system as well. Some resources that are available to you, I've mentioned one, Microsoft.com/SIR. This is previously and current published security intelligence reports. We've done three, two for the last for the first and second half of last year, and one for the first half of this year. We've already begun working on the next version, and we'll be bringing that out as soon as it's ready. The malicious, the Microsoft Malware Protection Center portal, Microsoft.com/security/portal, provides the top items that we detect at any given time, access to our online encyclopedia, the ability to submit samples to Microsoft for analysis, and other resources that you might be interested in. Anti-malware product information for IT professionals can be found at Microsoft.com/forefront. The malicious software removal tool, as well as links to knowledge base articles describing how to use that, how to use some of the advanced functionalities such as logging, how to suppress telemetry, and other items can be found at Microsoft.com/malware-remove. And Windows Defender, including resources for software vendors that are rated by Windows Defender, can be found at Microsoft.com/Windows Defender. Additional product information can be found at Windows Live OneCare at onecare.live.com. The OneCare Safety Scanner can be found at onecare.live.com/scan. Information on Microsoft Exchange hosted services at Microsoft.com/exchange/services. Forefront Client Security at Microsoft.com/client-security. Forefront Security for Exchange Server, the product formerly known as Antigen, at Microsoft.com/forefront/server-security/exchange. Microsoft Online Safety Technologies, such as relating to anti-spam and anti-phishing, can be found at Microsoft.com/safety. And information on the Sender ID framework can be found at Microsoft.com/Sender ID. And with that, we'll open the floor up to questions, starting with one that was previously submitted. What is Windows Live OneCare? Windows Live OneCare is Microsoft's antivirus and anti-spyware software targeted at consumers. It's an all-in-one package that provides antivirus and anti-spyware scanning, real-time protection against antivirus and virus and spyware, backup of critical files on the system, reliability tuning, and performance enhancement, as well as visibility and control into the system. It's designed for novice users. It's very simple to operate. It's available in a 3-license pack. I'm not certain of the pricing, but I suspect that that would be available on the web. And again, you can find more information at onecare.live.com. If I can bring the other presenters back on the line, if there are further questions, please type them into the question and answer pane. At present, we have no questions waiting, so if you would like to submit yours, we'd be happy to answer it. If not, that will be the conclusion of our session.
And what I'll go ahead and do, Jeff, is while we're waiting for more questions to come in, I will go ahead and get the survey for the sessions pulled up so everybody can get that filled out. Before I do that, I want to remind everybody that for more information, they can print a PDF of today's session. To do that, you just want to go to the File menu in your upper navigation bar. Now, I do encourage everybody, if you have a question, please submit it through the question manager. You just want to type it in and hit that Ask button. Also, I'm going to be posting a survey here in just a minute. If you would all please take a moment to fill that out before you log off. We do appreciate your feedback. For upcoming and previously recorded webcasts, you can visit Microsoft.com/webcast. You can go here to access this webcast, which will be available for download in about 24 hours. And if you have any webcast content ideas, something out there you'd like to see and haven't yet, we'd love to hear from you. Just take note of this link here. And now here's a survey from our session today. Please follow the links provided to complete today's webcast evaluation. And Jeff, do we have any questions waiting there for you?
We have nothing in the queue, but I'd like to thank all of the participants today, both the presenters and our audience, and I look forward to doing this again.
Excellent. And with that, I do want to extend a very special thank you to all of our presenters for your session today and for answering all the great questions we had come through the queue. Well, ladies and gentlemen, this will conclude today's session. Thanks again for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of today's presentation.
Hello. Thank you for listening to this webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio.com/survey to complete a quick evaluation. Thank you.